Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram weekend edition for Saturday, July 23rd, 2022. Seasonal trends push up unemployment. By Mella McEwen. Seasonal trends continued to influence Midland's labor market in June, among them contract workers not working it as schools closed for the summer. The Texas Workforce Commission said Friday that unemployment in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, which includes Midland and Martin counties, rose to 3.6%. It is still well below the 6.2% reported last June. Odessa saw a similar increase, rising to 5.3 from 4.8. Still, Willie Taylor, Chief Executive Officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin, sees strength in the area's labor market. Midland is seeing a strong market, he said. He said he has noted area man camps beginning to fill up as contract workers arrive to work construction, road, and other jobs. Taylor called Midland a job seekers market with a shortage of skilled labor, and as such, he said wages will continue to rise. Midland's dominant industrial sector, which includes oil and gas, has wages of over $842 million the final quarter of 21. He pointed out, more than twice second place trade, transportation, and utilities. Employment has made a quick recovery from the pandemic, and said as long as there remains a worker shortage, it will continue in that direction. He pointed out that Midland College and Odessa College, both are training strong programs, are forecasting growth. Taylor himself has visited with local school districts to observe their technical programs. Those programs, he said, are the feeder system into the workforce. Midland is not alone in the labor market strength, Taylor concluded. Look at Texas, even the U.S. They're creating jobs. Midland's civilian labor force grew almost 700 in May and is almost more than 101,000 counted last June. The number of unemployed Midlanders rose by almost 300. Midland added 800 jobs from May to June for a total of non-farm job count of 107,400. For the past 12 months, Midland added 6,400 jobs. Job gains were again led by the mining, logging, and construction with 3,300 new jobs. Hospitality gained 1,300. Statewide, the unemployment dipped to 4.1%, down from 4.2% in May. Most drillers have streamed operations. In the heart of the country's most productive oil basin, Jeff Sparks' family company, Discovery Operating, is behind on completing 6 wells. But we're drilling right now. I'm hoping to get finished on this horizontal pad by the end of the week. And then we'll get lined up and frack it. Discovery Operating, like other producers in the Permian Basin, has more work than it can handle, as rising demand for oil has pushed crude prices to over $120 a barrel this year. In the past, such soaring crude prices turned Midland into a temporary boomtown. Wildcatters moved in to search for oil, snapping up houses and apartments, and the town becomes flush with new wealth. When the inevitable bust slashes oil prices, companies cut workers and families move out. The current boom, according to longtime residents, Midland officials, and companies in the region, is more muted, with incremental advancements in drilling technology and the world's appetite for oil driving long-term investments. And that, experts say, could lead to more stability in rural communities accustomed to dramatic boom and bust cycles. The Permian Basin is set to boost daily output this year by 1 million barrels to an average of 5.5 million barrels, making it the largest producer behind Russia and Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, analysts say companies are more efficient at drilling for that oil than they have ever been. Operators are able to drill deeper, more productive wells with a smaller workforce. More so, companies have driven down the cost of fracking. Economists say when fracking first became feasible, drillers could break even with oil at about $80 a barrel. Today, that number is closer to $40 a barrel. That's the case for oil major Chevron. The San Ramon, California-based company, holds more than 2 million acres of land in the Permian Basin. On a recent afternoon just outside Midland, a Chevron drilling operator sat in the air-conditioned booth on the rig's platform, each hand on a control, as if the drill outside were a video game. On either side of him, two screens flashed data related to the well. The information on his screens, he said, is transmitted to a control center some 500 miles away in Houston, where the oil giant monitors all its active rigs. "It's a game changer," said Ryder Booth, leader of Chevron Houston-based Midland Continental Business Unit workforce working in Midland. "Having a central location means fewer people are needed on oil sites. Plus, information gathered from one rig can be quickly shared with other sites. If one rig learns how to do something to drill 5 feet longer in 30 less minutes, that's passed on to all the rigs. It's built into the system." Workers on the Chevron drilling site said drilling projects that used to take 30 days are often wrapped up within 2 weeks. In the past, there was also a need for workers called wildcatters to explore for new oil reserves. Nowadays, after decades of geological studies in the Permian by both company and government scientists, drillers know where the oil is, said economist Ray Perryman. "That's really almost no such thing as a wildcatter now. I mean, you know where the oil is at this point in time." The U.S. Geological Survey estimates at least 46 billion barrels of oil exist under the Permian's ground, according to a 2018 report. Additionally, Perryman said hydraulic fracturing technology enables Permian producers to reach hard to recover oil. "These fracked wells, you get a whole lot at first, then it drops off really quickly. But there's plenty more below that, so you have to go in and refrack it, so to speak, and so there's an ongoing employment base that wasn't here before." Companies don't just need crews to drill and then frack the wells initially, but will continue to need crews to go back to the well, frack it, and extract more oil. So while crews are getting smaller, workers are needed to return to projects. And Perryman said that's enticing companies to invest more in the community in hopes of attracting a steadier workforce with skills specific to oil and gas extraction. Some locals said oil and gas industry needs to invest in education and healthcare in the region, especially now that the Permian is expected to produce oil and needs workers for years to come. Enter the Permian Strategic Partnership, a group of about 17 energy companies working with local governments and foundations to steer investment into the community. These companies all have the exact same thing in common, and that's the need for a talented workforce. None of them are able to fully get the workforce that they need. Traditionally, oil and gas jobs have been focused on manual labor, but as more technology is adopted in the oil patch, companies are hungry for workers with digital expertise. Bentley said that's a problem in the Permian, which, despite being home to a couple of college and universities, still lacks many workforce training opportunities. On top of that, he said companies realize they need to help make the region grow more attractive for families, which means improving things like the area's hospitals and schools. The partnership is still young, but since its formation, it's invested more than $100 million to develop healthcare resources, attract and train teachers, and provide ongoing training to the Permian's workforce. Bentley expects investments to accelerate as many companies focus their efforts in the region. Underscoring the feeling in Midland that this boom is different is a commonly held belief that not only will the world need oil and gas for decades to come, but that conditions are ripe for the Permian to continue to being one of the major producers of that oil. The International Energy Agency's most recent outlook predicts a 47% surge in energy demand within the next 3 decades. While renewable energy sources are expected to become a larger part of the world's mix, many in Midland say oil and gas will continue to be a significant fuel source well past 2050, and the Permian is the best area to produce that oil and gas. Fossil fuels are here forever, said Terry Johnson, who owns oil and field gas service company Teo Field Services. And the Permian Basin, he said, is poised to help meet the world's energy needs for decades to come. Johnson said that also means the area will continue to experience the up and down cycles of the oil and gas industry, with fewer transient workers and more long-term investments in the region, making the 22 up cycle feel different from a previous one. It could mean fewer families fleeing the area when prices inevitably go down. And Johnson said prices will go down. It's just unclear when. Anybody says, I know what's going to happen next in the next 12 months, they don't know what they're talking about, because nobody knows. I'm here to tell you, I've been through 4 or 5 boom-bust cycles, but we'll have another bust. Officials find Houston man dead on the trail at Big Bend National Park. A 75-year-old Houston man died while hiking in Big Bend National Park. Big Bend Park's Communications Center received a call Thursday at about 7:45 p.m. about a fatality on the Chimneys Trail. Park rangers found the 75-year-old about a half mile from the trailhead. There was no obvious cause of death. On Thursday afternoon, the temperatures along the Chimneys Trail exceeded 104 degrees. The Chimneys Trail is described as a moderately difficult 5-mile round-trip hike to a series of prominent volcanic formations in the western desert of the park. The park staff and partners are saddened by the loss, and our entire park family extends sincere condolences to the hiker's family and friends. Hikers should be prepared to carry and drink a gallon of water per day and to plan being off desert trails by noon.
Hello, this is Michael, reading additional articles from the inside pages of the Midland Reporter-Telegram, published Saturday, July 23rd. Crude slumps, gasoline climbs, by Mella McEwen. Signals of softening European economies and weakening U.S. fuel demand sent crude prices lower for a third consecutive week. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange fell 3 of 5 trading days, ending the week below the $95 level. Prices had a strong start to the week, climbing $5 to $102.60 and adding $1.62 Tuesday to send prices above $104 before giving back those gains. Thursday brought the steepest drop, $3.53 per barrel, and sending prices below the $100 mark. Prices fell another $1.65 or 1.7% to end the week at $94.70 a barrel. That's down from $97.59 at last Friday's close and $102.60 at Monday's close. The posted price ended the week at $91.18, according to Plains All American. Natural gas on the NYMEX rose 3 of 5 trading days as the price rose above the $8 mark. The commodity started the trading week rising 46 cents to $7.48 per MCF, crossed the $8 mark Wednesday, jumping 74 cents to $8.01, and added 37 cents Friday to end the week at $8.30 per MCF. John Pasi, President Stratus Advisors, attributed the oil price decline to several factors, including the limited impact sanctions have had on Russia's ability to export crude and refined products. The growth in oil demand has moderated substantially because of slowing economy activity and wages that have lagged well below the overall inflation rate, Pasi told the Reporter Telegram by email. Additionally, China is still dealing with COVID-19. Through its zero COVID approach, which is restricting economic activity and the demand for oil. As for natural gas, Pasi said that prices have increased in part because of the widespread heat wave, which is increasing demand for power generation and the demand for natural gas. Also, he noted, inventory levels of natural gas in the U.S. and Europe are materially below typical levels for this time of year. He also said U.S. natural gas prices are now more affected by global supply and demand dynamics thanks to the increase in exports of U.S. liquefied natural gas. While Russia exports of crude oil and oil products have not been greatly affected, Russia's exports of natural gas have been reduced, with Europe receiving lower volumes. And because of logistical constraints, it is not possible for Russia to divert all those volumes to other regions. Therefore, the global supply-demand conditions are tighter, and natural gas prices in Europe and Asia are relatively high, he wrote. Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by email, "As commodity prices fluctuate, the oil and natural gas industry's ability to adapt is directly tied to certainty in policy. The industry's ability to navigate market and price volatility is greatly enhanced if we know what to expect and can plan accordingly. Americans and our allies need reliable, affordable energy, and our federal government should be doing everything it can to encourage domestic energy production, transportation, and processing." Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, likewise criticized policymakers for affecting prices. U.S. policymakers are placing undue demands on energy producers, he said in a statement that also touted a significant increase in upstream oil and gas employment in June. "If we want price stability and if we want to ensure a secure domestic energy supply, we need a stable regulatory environment in the U.S. policymakers, and the current administration must stop vilifying our industry and should work collaboratively with operators to develop a coherent federal energy policy strategy, including opening federal leasing, approving permitting for energy infrastructure, and again providing the regulatory certainty needed to support long-term investments that are necessary to address our own energy needs and those of our allies abroad." Edward Moya, senior market analyst with the Americas with Oanda, said in his daily newsletter, "The oil market remains tight despite troubling economic signs, keeping oil prices from breaking below the mid-90s. But this deterioration with the crude demand outlook should prevent a sustained move above the $100 level," he wrote. Grassroots Group to Discuss ECISD Reforms by Matt Stringer. Residents from across Ector County came together Tuesday evening for a first-of-its-kind meeting to discuss how best to go about assessing the needs of the Ector County Independent School District, with a hopeful goal of presenting their eventual findings to the school board. Two Odessa business owners, Jeff Russell and Jamie Tisdale, were inspired to establish the group A Better Way Forward after a roughly $400 million bond package not only failed to pass, but was heavily defeated in the recent May election. Both Russell and Tisdale have criticized how the bond proposal was crafted by the bond committee, indicating that the process didn't allow for and ultimately result in what the community needed to be proposed. The first meeting of the citizen-led effort was held in West Odessa at the Kellis Turner Park Community Center and was attended by nearly 50 residents from across Ector County, including local elected officials. Trust was one of the main factors discussed at the meeting, with Russell pointing out that for any proposals to be supported by the community must first trust the district in several areas, including finance, management, and academics. "We need to think outside the box," Russell stated, further saying, "We need to be thinking about how we are going to build facilities that are cost-effective, long-lasting, durable, and that doesn't break the bank." Russell expanded on that, adding that as the group works on answering those questions, they will also have to tackle other related issues such as underutilized campuses, redistricting, and every factor possible. That way, the community can have confidence that they explored every aspect of the needs of the district and left no stone unturned. One audience member weighed in, saying her problem with the district's bond committee was that too many factors, such as what Russell described, were off limits as it crafted the now failed bond proposal, and that she was encouraged that the Better Way Forward citizen-led group was leaving everything on the table for consideration. In addition, it was clarified that the goal of the group isn't to simply promote and propose a bond package. Rather, the group will present their findings to the school board, which could include recommendations on every area the group considers, such as management, district structure, and infrastructure recommendations. West Odessa resident Jess Christensen told Odessa Headlines he was surprised and pleased to see a high turnout for the event and said that it's going to take the community getting involved to make the project successful and expressed confidence that they will be able to craft a strong set of recommendations for the district. "I think it was a great turnout," Odessa Mayor Javier Hoven told Odessa Headlines. "I think this demonstrates that people want to be engaged, that people want to come out and feel like they can have genuine input on the process and be taken seriously. And I think that hasn't been the case in the past for a lot of the people who are here today," Hoven stated. "You can't get more grassroots than this group, and I am so excited to see a strong kickoff." Group co-founder Jamie Tisdale stated that she felt the event turnout was great. "I feel optimistic about the ideas that were discussed tonight," Tisdale said, adding, "We talked about transparency, spending, accountability, and we assigned some tasks to the group members, and we will come back with another meeting in 2 weeks and see where we are at." ECISD board member Chris Stanley, who was in attendance, said he loved the event and was excited to see such a diverse collection of citizens from all sides of the county. "This movement will no doubt result in a bunch of good information," Stanley stated, further adding, "I concur with what Mr. Russell said about getting good demographic information because we all know that's very hard to do. I think it's exciting to work with people who are willing to solve things and not just burn things down." Stanley added that he was excited to see what proposals will ultimately be in the group's recommendation to the school board. "The Better Way Forward group will now begin forming committees and working to go through ideas and directions submitted by every citizen participating in the project, and will hold another organizational meeting in 2 weeks. The meetings will be held in different locations across Ector County, signifying the needs and interests of all areas of the community." New TV series features Midland resident by Robin Bradshaw, Texas Digital Reporter. Midland resident Brandy Bell will be featured in a new television program, Keeping Good Company. The show is based on a small farm in Midland and highlights West Texas and the importance of community in the area, according to a series press release. Each episode is set to feature a mix of acts of kindness and inspirational stories from across the region, while sharing craft ideas, travel clips, gardening, cooking, and baking tips, and more, the release states. "The show's message is straightforward," Bell explained in the release. "Love your neighbor, inspire kindness, and celebrate often." Season 1 will consist of 8 episodes beginning August 25th and will air on KWES K-West News West Channel 9 at 1 p.m. on Thursday as a part of a bi-weekly program schedule. Viewers can follow Brandy Bell and the company on Keeping Good Company website for additional program information. As part of the series premiere, Keeping Good Company will be featured across several West Texas cities, including Midland, Odessa, Monahans, Big Spring, and Lubbock. Texas tour schedule. The series will also include what is described as a Texas tour of sorts, which is set to run from August 1st through August 24th. For more information about the specific dates, scheduled events, and updates, please visit the Keeping Good Company website. The tour is comprised of visits to coffee shops, retailers, restaurants, breweries, and other local West Texas businesses, reads a portion of the release. At these events, members of the local community are invited to join host Brandy Bell and her incredible crew. Unfortunately, the short article does not include the URL address for this website. Rural Hospital Rescue Plan Faces Skepticism by Sarah Jane Tribble and Tony Lays, Kaiser Health News. In West Texas, the tiny hospital in Crosbyton has only 2 beds, and they're not always occupied. We rarely admit patients, said Steve Beck, chief executive of the hospital, which is 40 miles east of Lubbock and serves a town of about 1,500 residents. The hospital has trouble keeping staff, and we're lacking in technology and expertise, he said, and money. The town has hosted bake sales and garage sales to keep its emergency room and primary care services open. On paper, Crosbyton Clinic Hospital shouldn't exist, Beck said, but it does by sheer determination and commitment and work ethic. In states with many rural hospitals, like Texas, Kansas, and Iowa, hundreds of these facilities have fewer than three patients staying overnight on any given day. The financial strain of staffing and maintaining those beds takes a toll, and federal lawmakers last year responded to pleas for help from hospital officials in places like Crosbyton. The Rural Emergency Hospital Program, slated to launch in January, will offer to pay small, struggling hospitals to drop their inpatient beds and focus solely on emergency and outpatient care. It will be the first new federal payment program for rural hospitals in 25 years, and lawmakers hope it stems the flow of rural hospital closures that accelerated over the past decade. The law is an unprecedented approach to maintain access to emergency health care in these communities, Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat, Oregon, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, which would oversee any changes to the law in the Senate, said in a statement to KHN. Yet state hospital leaders predict the program may find few immediate takers. The plan would boost payments for a hospital's Medicare patients and provide an additional flat facility payment. But the exact size of those payments and whether they will be enough to shore up struggling hospitals is unclear, even after the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services released an initial proposed rule just before the 4th of July weekend. A final rule is expected this fall. In Kansas, where an estimated 40 hospitals reported an average inpatient count of one or two before the COVID-19 pandemic, no hospitals are ready to raise their hands to join the program, said Jennifer Findlay, Vice President of Education and Special Projects for the Kansas Hospital Association. The hospitals are waiting very anxiously for officials at CMS to release more details on the funding, Findlay said. CMS's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Lee Fleischer, responded to KHN's questions about the new program with an emailed statement in June that confirms the agency is on target to launch the program by January 2023. Agency officials declined to answer any further questions. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican, Iowa, confirmed this month that CMS will roll out the new law in a series of proposed regulations. Grassley, who co-sponsored legislation that led to the creation of the program, urged the agency to do so in a timely manner. The rural emergency hospital model builds on Medicare's critical access hospital designation, which hospitals signed up for only after a series of amendments. The existing program allows Medicare to give additional funds to small rural hospitals that have no more than 25 inpatient beds and whose average patient length of stay is 96 hours or less. Grassley said in an interview with KHN that requiring rural hospitals to maintain inpatient units that are nearly empty is impractical. He wanted to offer an alternative to shutting down and not having any delivery of health care. Grassley emphasized that the new program will be voluntary. The law was a compromise, he said. Wyden objected to the costs of the original proposal, estimated at about $30 billion over 10 years. In the bill's initial final version, the boost to Medicare was lowered and the cost estimate dropped by more than two-thirds. In his statement to KHN, Wyden said the law was designed to fill in specific gaps in the existing federal safeguards. Although the Medicare reimbursement is smaller than originally proposed, the law also includes a facility fee, which is paid regardless of how many patients a hospital serves. CMS officials haven't yet disclosed the size of those payments, but Brock Slabach, Chief Operations Officer for National Rural Health Association, said hospitals need them to be $2 million to $3 million a year. But politicians in Washington are nervous about spending, and there's a general suspicion about this program being valuable, Slabach said. Comments from rural health advocates and hospital system administrators indicate they're also wary of the still amorphous framework of the Rural Hospital Rescue. In regulatory comment letters filed last year, health systems and rural hospital organizations emphasized the importance of the facility payment. They also asked about participation in a federal discount drug program and the potential for overnight swing beds, which are beds that could be used for patients needing acute care after surgery or for an illness, such as pneumonia, and for those who need skilled nursing while recovering.
Catherine Natalia Swan Browder passed away. She will be buried at Alta Mesa Memorial Park in Palo Alto, California on October 10th, following a memorial service in Los Altos, California on October the 8th. She is greatly missed by all. Melva Mahaney passed away on July the 16th. The family is planning a memorial service August 13th, with details pending. Arrangements are under the direction of Schaefer Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at schaeferpioneer.com. Wanda Mae Kendrick passed away on July 13th. Visitation will be Sunday, July 24th at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home from 6 to 8 p.m. Funeral service will be Monday, July 25th at Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church at noon. Cremation services to follow.
Hello, this is Michael reading the first article from the Odessa American, Saturday, July 23rd, front page. Restraining order issued against Jaguars by Kim Smith. A temporary restraining order was issued against Jaguars Adult Entertainment Club Thursday at the request of Ector County District Attorney Dusty Gallivan, who described the club in court documents as a common nuisance, notorious for harboring habitual criminal activity. Jaguars owners or staff will be given 14 days to modify their behavior to prevent criminal activity from occurring. After that two-week period, if an agreement can't be worked out between Jaguars and the county, a hearing will be held before County Court at Law No. 2, Judge Christopher Clark, to determine next steps. According to Gallivan's petition for the TRO, defendants knowingly tolerate and have failed to make reasonable efforts to abate the criminal activities at Jaguars and instead have enjoyed a steady stream of income from overly intoxicated patrons who conduct these illegal activities on the premises. During the three-year period from July 14, 2019 to July 14, 2022, Gallivan alleges the Odessa Police Department has been summoned to Jaguars on Cargo Road 150 times and made more than 100 arrests. Officers have responded to fights in progress, shots fired, aggravated assaults, alcohol-related crashes, and drug-related calls. He further alleges acts of prostitution have taken place at Jaguars and intoxicated people have participated in deviant behavior there. Messages and emails sent to the club's owner, RCI Hospitality Holdings, RCI President Eric Langwin, and Jaguars manager Nicolay Orcutt weren't immediately returned. According to Gallivan's petition, the criminal activities at the club present a danger to the public and cause people of ordinary sensibilities to be substantially frightened, discomforted, annoyed, and inconvenienced in the use of any premises surrounding the property, the petition stated. Defendants have failed or refused to abate the nuisance, and defendants are likely to continue to maintain the property as a common nuisance unless restrained by an injunctive order by the court, the petition reads. According to the petition, if the TRO is violated, the judge can impose a fine of $1,000 to $10,000 and or send the violator to jail for 10 to 30 days. He can also order the business's utilities be shut off, revoke its certificate of occupancy, restrict access to the business, and limit its business hours. In related news, RCI Hospitality, which also owns Rick's Cabaret Odessa, announced it closed on a purchase agreement that will enable subsidiaries to open a third nightclub in Nectar County. The club at 3306 Northwest Loop 338 will be called PT's Show Club and will offer quality adult entertainment with liquor service. According to its website, RCI has clubs in New York City, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Miami, Minneapolis, Denver, St. Louis, Charlotte, Pittsburgh, Raleigh, and Louisville.
This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, July 23rd. Party celebrates Odessans' 50 years of law. Judges, attorneys, court reporters, family, and friends descended upon Mike Holmes' office Friday to help him celebrate his 50th year of practicing law. Although a member of Ector County District Court's security detail accidentally spoiled what was supposed to be a surprise, Holmes said he was incredibly touched by the thought. "It's a real warm feeling," Holmes said. He was also tickled because his daughter Misty made a surprise appearance from Hutto, Texas, and his son David, an attorney from Austin, dropped by on his way to a Colorado vacation. Holmes, 75, was born in La Mesa but grew up in Odessa. He attended Burnett Elementary, what used to be Hood Junior High, Permian High School, and Odessa College. After earning his bachelor's degree in business administration from University of Texas, he went to the University of Texas School of Law, graduated in 1971, and passed the state bar in 1972. Erlene Peters, who has worked in various capacities for Holmes for 45 years, said he knew he wanted to be an attorney at the age of 8. His father, Bill, was a court reporter and friend of legendary attorney Warren Burnett, and Holmes grew up playing chess with him, Peters said. Prior to becoming Ector County District Attorney in 1981, Holmes had worked as a tax accountant, associate attorney, law firm partner, and solo practitioner. Peters and Holmes did an incredible job during his 4 years as DA, despite having little experience in criminal law. She said he was the first district attorney to hire a woman peace officer as a DA investigator and the first to hire a female assistant district attorney. Holmes has taught business law at Odessa College and communications law at UTPB, and he's been an alternate municipal court judge since 1988. Although he retired from family law, Holmes remains busy with criminal law, CPS cases, and probate cases. "Right now I've got the biggest caseload I've ever had, other than when I was DA," Holmes said. Although three-quarters of his law school class have retired, he has no plans to do so anytime soon. He tries to walk 6 miles a day to remain physically and mentally fit. "He's been lucky to have had such a great staff over the years, and the huge majority of the time, he enjoys the judges and the attorneys," he said. "One thing I've always been appreciative of is that we can be the biggest adversaries in the courtroom, but when we leave, we can still be friends," Holmes said. Susan Holmes, who will celebrate her 23rd wedding anniversary with Holmes on Sunday, said she knows how his career will end. "Somebody someday is going to call me from the courthouse or his office to tell me, 'Mike just fell over and he's dead,' because he loves what he does and I don't see him ever stopping," Susan said. "Her husband is a walking encyclopedia," she said. "He's an avid reader and he knows a lot about everything. What people don't know is just how emotionally wrapped up Holmes gets with his cases, especially those involving children in the care of Child Protective Services. It's where his heart is," Susan said. "He wrestles with and even cries when children aren't placed where he felt they had the best opportunity to succeed."
Hello, this is Michael, continuing with additional articles from the Odessa American, Saturday, July 23rd. County could sell Ector County Coliseum. The Ector County Coliseum could be sold to a company out of California. The agenda for Tuesday's Ector County Commissioners Court lists an action item to approve a broker contract between the county and JL Heritage Copper Key Realty. The meeting, scheduled at 10 a.m. Tuesday at the Courthouse Annex, follows a recent executive session where commissioners were reportedly offered between $20 and $25 million for the facility that has always been a county complex and is home to the Jackalopes, the Permian Basin Fair and Expo, and the Sandhills Stock Show and Rodeo. There has been no public discussion of selling the Coliseum. GOP County Judge-elect Dustin Fawcett, who won't take office until January, said he believes public discussion is critical and that folks need to hear the pros and cons of any potential sale. He said it is not a moneymaker for the county, but that it does bring in activities and economic activity. He said it would be important to iron out details that maintain the Sandhills, the Tejano Car Show, Mary Marketplace, the fair, and the oil show. We would, I think, need to make sure we still have a stake in those things. How much would be enough for the Coliseum? For me, that's what I would do. He said there would need to be guarantees that whoever purchases the building and lands won't flip it to someone else who would not be obligated to maintain contracts for the yearly events, like the fair and Mary Marketplace, that are important to the community. He said a private company might be able to bring in more events and promote it, but I don't have many details, he said. There should be public discussion, he said. Officer recovers stolen Rolex watches. An officer investigating an assault Wednesday ended up solving a car burglary that resulted in the theft of 8 Rolex watches worth $215,000. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an Odessa man called police on Monday to report someone broke into his GMC Sierra when it was parked outside a Dollar General store in the 6800 block of East Ridge Road and made off with 8 Rolex watches, a St. Laurent duffel bag worth $1,300, and a Hermes bracelet valued at $1,200. 2 days later, a woman who had just been assaulted told an OPD officer she had loaned her vehicle to Edgar Gonzalez Montez, 34, on Monday, and when he came back, he showed her 8 Rolex watches he said he had gotten from a vehicle outside a Dollar General store. He also showed her a burglary tool, the report stated. During the investigation, the officer heard Montez tell the assault victim he still had 6 of the watches, according to the report. Accused kidnapper arrested. A 37-year-old man is in the Ector County Jail, accused of kidnapping 3 women and trying to sexually assault at least one of them. According to the Ector County Sheriff's Office, a woman told deputies she was kidnapped and taken to a location off of South Grandview Avenue around 2:30 p.m. Wednesday. Her kidnapper was attempting to rape her when an oil field worker drove up, prompting the man to remove her from her vehicle and flee. The oil field worker gave deputies a description of the vehicle and part of its license plate number, and deputies spotted the vehicle around 5 p.m. near Pagewood Avenue and University Boulevard. The driver of the vehicle, Javier Martinez Arias, 37, matched the description of the suspected kidnapper, and deputies were able to confirm it was the same man, according to the sheriff's office. After more investigation, 2 other women told deputies Arias had also kidnapped them, a sheriff's office news release stated. Arias has been booked into the Ector County Jail on suspicion of aggravated kidnapping, causing serious bodily injury, and aggravated kidnapping. He's being held on 2 surety bonds totaling $2 million. A third charge is expected to be filed soon as all of the proper paperwork is obtained, said Sheriff Mike Griffiths, noting Arias is believed to have been beaten, to have beaten all 3 victims. All involved did a great job getting this predator off the street, Griffiths said.
This is Jane, recording for the Saturday Odessa American for July 23rd, from the obituary and death notice section. In Odessa, Rafaela Herrera de Sigala, age 88, passed away in the early morning hours on Tuesday, July 19th. She was born in Mexico on Tuesday, October 24th, 1933, to the late Teodoro and Adela Herrera. She married Jose Sigala in Mexico in 1945 and they became proud parents of 13 children. Visitation will begin at Acres West 24-Hour Chapel on Saturday, July 23rd at 12 p.m. Rosary will be recited at the 24-Hour Chapel on Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Mass of Christian Burial will be celebrated at Holy Redeemer Catholic Church on Monday, July 25th at 10 a.m. Burial follows at Sunset Memorial Gardens Cemetery. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West, and condolences may be sent to the family online at acreswestfuneral.com. She was preceded in death by her parents, her beloved husband, Jose Sigala, and four sons, Francisco, Diego, Ramon, Francisco Ariolo. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West Funeral Chapel in Odessa. Condolences to the family may be made online at acreswestfuneral.com. In Odessa, Caitlin Marie Acres, age 13, was suddenly and unexpectedly called to her heavenly destination on July 10th. She is survived by her mother, Erica Childress, her father, Jason Acres, her sisters, Jalen and Kylie Acres, and Alyssa Wicklander, and brother, Dylan Acres, all of Odessa. Caitlin was able to save lives by organ donation, for doing amazing things to give others a chance at life. Her mission is not yet finished. In lieu of flowers, please consider contributing to LifeGift at lifegift.org, make a contribution, or send checks to LifeGift, West Region, 5812 64th Street, Lubbock, Texas, 79424. Visitation will be held from 5 to 9 p.m. on Friday, July 22nd in the Chapel of Odessa Funeral Home. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday, July 30th in the Chapel of Odessa Funeral Home, with a reception to follow at Emmanuel Baptist Church. Fond memories and expressions of sympathy may be shared at www.odessafuneralhome.com for the Acres family. In Odessa, Nita Jeanette Turrentine Tyner, 75, passed away at her home on Wednesday, July 20th, surrounded by her family. She was born October 7th, 1946, in Commerce, Texas, to Wilson Irby Turrentine and Lillian Lavina Turrentine. Graveside services will be held Monday, July 25th, at 9 a.m. at Sunset Memorial Gardens, with Lynn Money officiating. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts may be made to St. Jude Children's Hospital, Shriner Hospital, or the Texas Lions Camp. The family wishes to thank the following for their excellent care and compassion: Dr. Darrell Parsons of Odessa, UMC Lubbock Oncology Department, Dr. Bora and staff of Texas Oncology and Odessa Home Hospice. In Odessa, Gerald Michael Frost dropped the mic and exited the stage July 14th in the Great Odessa. He was introduced to the stage of life on July 28, 1954, by Joanne Ada and Gerald Michael Frost Sr. in Denville, New Jersey. The list of people he picked on and laughed at in fun and love would be too long to list. Those left to cherish his memory are his children, Christy, Angel, and Victoria Frost, and Thomas Cotton, his sisters Linda Bava and her husband Bruce of Odessa, and her other sister Robin Frost, also of Odessa. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West Funeral Chapel. Condolences to the family may be made online at acreswestfuneral.com. In Odessa, Constant K. Brooks, 83, died on Wednesday, July 20th. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. July 26th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Burial to follow at Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Melvin A. Yarbrough, 51, of Odessa, died on July 19th. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. July 25th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Jimmy Dennis is officiating. Arrangements or by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Verna S. Headley of Odessa passed away on July 17th at home surrounded by her four children. She was born on April 29th, 1932, to Jane Potter Schulte and Joe Schulte in Jacksonville, Texas. Memorial service will be officiated by Donnie Williams at the Bridge Church on Tuesday, July 26th at 11 a.m. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. She is survived by her children, Lisa H. Zerker, Laura H. Nunez, Linda Freeman, and Emmett Headley, and also her 13 grandchildren. Memorials may be given to the Straight Line Foundation, 3607 Golder Avenue, Odessa, 79764, or the charity of your choice. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign her guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com.
Hello, friends. This is Julie, reading from the Odessa American, from Sunday, July 24th. City Considering Park Lease with UTPB, by Kim Smith. The Odessa City Council is considering a potential two-year lease with UTPB for the Jurassic Jungle Spray Ground. Last September, the City University of Texas, Percy Memory Basin, ended a 25-year lease agreement allowing city residents to use the sports complex at the university. Rather than removing the Jurassic Jungle Spray Ground, which was largely paid for by the Junior League of Odessa, the city opted to leave it outside for 2 years. During last year's work session meeting, City Manager Mike Marano told the council university officials recently informed him they hoped to charge the city $78,000 a year for the use of the 7,000 square foot area. However, Marano said the attorneys for the city and UTPB have since developed a joint settlement agreement that will allow city residents to continue to use the park at no cost to the city for 2 years because of prior contributions the city has made to the university. Those contributions totals $208,936. Following the meeting, Assistant City Manager Philip Urita explained the city provided the college with Hotel Moto tax funds to continue its sports operations. He also pointed out the city continues to pay for the maintenance of the park, the chemicals used, the electricity, and the lifeguard at the location. City Council member Steve Thomas said if the City Council approves the two-year lease, he would not be opposed to removing all of the equipment at the end of the lease and placing it elsewhere. My problem is that $78,000 a year, that's going to get pretty pricey down the road, Thompson said. However, Councilmember Tom Sprawls pointed out that Marano told him several months ago it would be quite costly to relocate the equipment. In my initial discussion with Parks Director Steve Patton, I think he indicated that the cost we built that facility was around $1.4 million. And it would be almost as much to relocate a lot of the cost and of so much the items. It's the underground portions, Marano said. And the council directed city staff to explore exactly how much it would cost to relocate the spray ground and the play area. New Jordan Principal Looks Forward to a New Experience, by Ruth Campbell. William Eicher is super excited to be selected as the new principal for Jordan Elementary School. Currently an assistant principal at Wilson and Young Medal and Honor Middle School, he has been with Ector County ISD for 10 years. Previously, he served in the U.S. Army for 20 years, leaving as a sergeant first class. Originally from Atlanta, Georgia, Eicher moved around the country and the world: Germany, South Carolina, Alabama, Missouri, Korea, Hawaii, Washington State, and California. He and his wife, Rachel, have 5 children. His wife was previously a special education teacher for 8 years, now works for American Momentum Bank. Eicher earned his bachelor's degree in history from Columbia College while he was in the Army and his master's degree in educational leadership from University of Texas at the Permian Basin. Columbia College is in Columbia, Missouri. The military partners with local colleges, so he was able to take classes at Fort Leonard Wood. It's one of those unique situations that the military provides for the service members, Eicher said. He started off as a teacher coach at Ector Middle School before he became an in-district charter. Within the first year and two of his military career, Eicher said he was steering towards education. From that point on, I tried to drive my career towards instruction and being a military instructor and having those opportunities, he said. His father was in the military and his wife as well. They got married in Hawaii. Eicher said his military background helps him in education. It gives me a good foundation. It also gives me the ability to deal with people. Build those quality relationships quickly because the rotation in the military comes so quickly. That building relationships is fundamental in the military, so it's made for an easier transition when I moved into education. I just found it easier to build those quality relationships with adults and students, Eicher said. Having spent his career at middle schools, Eicher said he's looking forward to becoming an elementary principal. It's a change. It's an opportunity to grow. I've been in the middle school my whole career, so there are those challenges of just learning what goes on in the elementary school. So I'm just super excited to expand my horizons and my professional career, Eicher said. His goal at Jordan will be to grow teachers so they can grow students and close gaps and bring parents back into the school to help with their children's education. Jordan has about 800 students in his grades, kindergarten through fifth. Right now, I think they're a C-rated campus. Our goal is to be an A-rated campus. It should take about 3 to 4 years to do that, with incremental growth. We're not rushing anything like overnight success, Eicher said. He added that he's looking forward to starting the year and working with the teachers at Jordan. I've heard nothing but great things about Barbara Jordan and the staff over there and the family they have over there. I'm just eager to be part of that and get there and see where we can grow, see how I can help them grow. We can teach those goals of becoming an A campus, Eicher said. He added that he's learned a lot from being at Wilson and Young and enjoyed working with the administrative team because they are so cohesive. The campus has about 1,250 students in grades 6 through 8. It gives you an opportunity to focus on the things you want to grow on. And just so having the great admin team and then just a school full of professional teachers, it's just amazing, Eicher said. He added that it's tough to find schools where the administration team and staffing are so closely aligned and focus what they're trying to accomplish. Chief of Schools, Kelly Simpson, and Eicher is committed to the Jordan community. As a member of the community himself, he is passionate about expanding opportunities for parent engagement and ensuring that students have an exceptional school year, Simpson said. He is a systems thinker and is highly involved with all aspects of teaching and learning. She added, he's great at designing and implementing systems based on needs.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.